Hello, everyone. I hope you're doing well. I'm Patrick Casey, sitting in for Henrik Palmgren, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Our guest today is Matthew Drake. Matthew is best known for his YouTube channel, where his videos feature original illustrations that highlight important social and political issues. Welcome to the show, Matthew. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking.
Well, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I am a YouTuber and an artist, and I would also call myself a philosopher. And for those who haven't seen my work, what I do is I take 10 to 15 minute clips on YouTube that I find interesting, usually having a nationalist bent, and I illustrate those just using a pen, and I record myself drawing. I then speed it up about 10 times so that it gives a cool whiteboard effect. And I started doing this about 2 years ago, and since then I've gained a little bit of a following, and some people really like what I'm doing. Plus, it gives me a chance to network with people in alt-right, people in the, well, really from all over the political spectrum, but generally more on the right. And yeah, I've always been interested in politics, and I actually started out, if you can believe it or not, as more of a neocon. I was one of those people who was rooting for Bush in around the 9/11 era, and I'm a little embarrassed to talk about that now, but since then I wised up and I actually moved on to become a libertarian through people like Tom Woods, Peter Schiff, and especially Stefan Molyneux, who's been a big influence on my thinking. So I was, you know, I've done a little bit of work back in the day. I tried doing some podcasts back then, and I actually spoke at the Porcupine Freedom Festival in New Hampshire. And so it was only a couple of years ago when the alt-right started taking off that I saw some of these faces, you know, the Jared Taylors and so on. And a lot of times they were guests on Stefan's show, and just started looking at more of these people and getting interested in race, you know, race and IQ. That's, you know, a big part of my evolution. And so now, although I usually eschew labels, I would consider myself somewhere between alt-right and libertarian. I don't like either of those terms, but I guess I could be called some kind of an anarcho-fascist or maybe paleo-libertarian. And I'm happy to get into that more later, but I think I'm just a regular guy who sees what's happening around me, and I can't ignore it. And so I'm also dedicated to finding out the truth, and it's just been such a good journey in my time as a nationalist, and I really do find comfort in the people. So I think that no matter where you are on the political spectrum, it's good to look at the people who are around you and you know, see, are these the type of people who I want to become? And so the alt-right, they've got a lot of great people, and their message is about self-improvement, and that really resonates with me. And I think that's why they've gained so much traction since Donald Trump was campaigning. And it's really been exciting, and I'm really ready to see what comes next. There's a lot of exciting things happening in the movement.
Absolutely. So you said that you're somewhere between being alt-right and being a libertarian. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what attracts you to libertarianism? And then at the same time, what about libertarianism you feel is lacking enough so that you don't fully identify as one?
Yeah. So what attracts me, I think, is the idea of sovereignty. And I use that word specifically over individualism, because individualism has been co-opted. And so I like the idea that that each person is sovereign, and each above that, each family is sovereign, and above that, each community is sovereign. And you know, in fascism, you have this idea that it's the bundle of sticks, right? And so the bundle of sticks, when they're bound together, they can't be broken. And that is one of the flaws of libertarianism, you could say. But I don't think there's anything fundamentally contradictory. It just means that the individual must find a collective to exist within. And so, you know, property rights, all of these things, which are the first things to go when leftists infiltrate libertarian circles. The idea of that you own your own body, and therefore you take responsibility for it. This is the thing that they want to do away with. They want to just say, well, you own your own body, therefore you're allowed to ruin it. And what sovereignty should give people is the ability to become better people, not worse people. So there's a lot of things about libertarianism that I find attractive. And specifically anarchism, anarcho-capitalism. I still believe that the thinking behind that is irrefutable. I think that, you know, although I hate the term non-aggression principle, because people have also abused that term, we don't want a world in which you're able to be coerced by much larger groups. And the problem that I see with a lot of statist thinking is that the more power you give to governments, the more likely you are for that power to be corrupted. And although it might initially be good for the person that you're coercing, there is that possibility that someone evil will come and take up that power and use it to abuse people. And we've certainly seen that with the United States and since its founding, since its conception. So I still want there to be this idea of secession, where if you are not happy with the collective you're in, then you're able to see that you have a route. You know, if you think of a government or a society as a family, it really is kind of just an extended family, and that's where the word nation comes from, right? And that's what nationalism is about. And I think that if you think of a family still has rules, right? And they impose those rules on children, oftentimes against the children's desires. But there is opportunity for negotiation. And of course, there's always the it's the old saying, if you don't like it, well, you can just leave, right?
Right.
At least after you're 18. And I think, actually, I would say that is more applicable to societies, because adults have fully functioning brains and we're autonomous human beings. Whereas, you know, I think that there should be some kind of, maybe you could call it communism in the family, in the just nuclear unit, where what's best for the whole kind of takes priority.
Yeah, definitely. One term that I like in particular is identitarian, because I feel like it really gets to the main issue, at least for us, you know, in the alt-right and in nationalist circles, which is identity. And it allows, you know, identitarianism transcends debates on on things like, you know, economics, religion, and so forth. So it allows us all to unite around, you know, our shared destiny, essentially. So I feel, you know, within identitarianism, you can have libertarian leanings, you can have socialist leanings, but you're united by what matters, which is, you know, understanding that you're part of the same in-group and that you need to work together. So for within an identitarian context, debates over between libertarianism and socialism and, you know, even monarchism or something of that sort, they become, you know, it's similar to how a sports team would argue about, you know, which play they want to do or, you know, which players they want to put in. People are going to have drastically different opinions on what the best path is, but everyone's on the same page about the fact that they're trying to win, like that they're trying to work for their team, right? You know, a football team, you don't have to convince people that they should win and that they should work together to win. So how do you feel about the term identitarian?
I like the term, and the problem that I have in general with labels is that, or more so labels that define movements, is that it can be co-opted. And I think everyone listening to this probably knows that it is a common thing for subversive elements to come in and try to take over wherever the new, usually white people are coalescing around a movement. And so, you know, I do like the idea as a kind of with a lowercase I, if you will. So, yeah, I like identitarian.
Yeah, there is something to be said for the fact that if you fully commit to one label, then yeah, someone else could come along or a group of people could come along and use that label and run it into the ground. So, I mean, there's always the risk of doing that. But then at the same time, you do want to have, you know, I think it is on a personal level, I understand wanting to avoid labels. But if you're trying to have an organization or a movement, I think it's good to have, you know, some term that kind of unites you. And
I think that we shouldn't give up on nationalism just mm-hmm. because it's sort of been co-opted by civic nationalists. Right. I would say they're not the true nationalists. I would say that we are the traditional, I don't even like the word traditional, but we are
the authentic nationalists.
Real sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, why would you say that?
Well, yeah, actually, Lauren Rose had a good video about this on how the word nation really just means a people and coming around a common people. And it has nothing to do with values, really. Well, it does have something to do with values indirectly insofar right. that a common people usually share values and goals. But yeah, this has just been common knowledge throughout history. And it's, you know, I wish that we didn't always sound like fuddy-duddies sometimes. And that's why I kind of like identitarian, because it sounds a little bit newer. You don't right. sound so much like you're, you know, someone still stuck in the 80s or 50s. I think that we can take back the term nationalism. And I think we can use that to mean people. And, you know, in America, it's been so slandered, and the idea of this proposition nation, where you have lots of different cultures that have come in, and so they always say, well, it's not a white nation because we're all immigrants. You know, we all came and we actually took land from the natives, so you can't say that we really belong here. But mm-hmm. I reject that entirely. I say that we have been here for a long enough time where our the white Americans have really become this new ethnic group, and so that's how I reconcile that. And of course, they want to then say, well, why can't we just have a new ethnic group, which is all mixed together, and we're all this brown beige thing, you know, on the cover of Time magazine, it's just this generic face that's an amalgam of all different races. And for one thing, I would come back and say that that is destroying diversity. And there's some great memes that go around, you know, you mix all the colors together and you get no colors. So if you really want to celebrate diversity, then you should be strongly in support of borders. And of course, this is exposing people for their real intentions, I believe, behind it, which is to get rid of white people. And just have maybe some of them do actually want this brown beige thing to inherit the earth, but that again goes against my libertarian instincts of, you know, having distinct groups and having people who can disagree and live separately with their disagreements. And I think Trump is really kind of demonstrating this to the world in his foreign policy, not so much in Syria, of course, but in other parts of the world, where he's showing that these quote-unquote dictators, we can deal with them as people, and if you treat them as people, you might be surprised and find that you can find some commonalities, you can come to terms, because, of course, we are different nations and we don't exist. But of course, the left, I think they really want to have one world government. And they want to, of course, be the rulers of that. And I would say, over my dead body.
Yeah, that's what the logical conclusion of globalism seems to be. It seems to be, you know, a more unified, connected world. That's how they sell it. And it definitely appeals to people who see, you know, John Lennon's Imagine as, you know, a good model for the world. But it really just does seem to be consolidating power into the hands of, you know, internationalist billionaires, essentially, you know, international banking, mega corporations, and so forth. Those are the people who are going to be ruling over this unified world. And I think that some people on the left have started to realize that a lot of these interests, the powers that be, like George Soros and so forth, actually do share many of their progressive views. So, you know, perhaps they're not as opposed to it, even though they know that, you know, there are elite interests behind the push for globalism. But yeah, I mean, it does threaten natural diversity. And what you were talking about with, you know, the idea that there's going to be this new ethnic group that comes about that's going to be totally racially mixed and it's not going to have any connection to the past. I mean, the fact that people see that as a good thing is very alarming, because essentially what we're talking about there is a new underclass of consumers who have virtually no connection to the past, to a particular ethnic group. They don't have a tribe, and they're just consumers. They're going to be dependent on the government, and they're going to be fully susceptible to conditioning and to eating up whatever globalists and progressives indoctrinate them into.
Yeah, they're these kind of 85 IQ mud people. They're kind of obese. They might have their eccentricities where they like, you know, a particular Netflix show or something, but everything's being fed to them. Just kind of this drip, drip, drip of consumerism. And that is the goal. And, you know, when I first started thinking about a lot of these, this idea, it seems sort of like a conspiracy. And it seems a little insane. Like, are there really people who are that twisted and evil that they just want to enslave humanity? I mean, how satanic is that? But you see the empirical evidence over and over again, and I'm someone who really likes patterns. I like puzzles. I like looking at things visually, and so I just can't help but notice this again and again. And of course, they condemn me for that. and they condemn a lot of us just for noticing what's going on.
Right.
And this is kind of why I've become more religious over the past couple of years, is that I see there are these satanic elements in society that are pushing in a certain direction, and it's going to take a holy reconquista of some sort, or binding together of good people to push back against that. We're not going to be able to do it individually or just based on our own whims. You know, we're going to have to find a higher purpose, because the enemy is real, and they are out for blood. They don't see this as a game. This is existential for them.
You know, using the term satanic to describe globalism is a very interesting, and progressivism as well, is I find that very interesting. I'm not an atheist, but I'm not a Christian, at least perhaps a lapsed Catholic. But I do think that many aspects of what's going on and what is being promoted in the media and so forth could be described as satanic. How all of our values have been inverted, right? Everything that was considered virtuous, good, and wholesome for most of Western history has been pathologized, and it's the opposite: vice, ugliness, you know, sexual promiscuity, sickness. All of that has been kind of elevated as if, you know, those things are virtues in themselves. And yeah, I think they could be described as satanic. It is very, you know, it's the elevation of these destructive lifestyles, of just really grotesque aesthetics, really has become a defining part of progressivism. So I can definitely relate to where you're coming from there.
Well, what is the old saying? The greatest trick the devil played was convincing the world he didn't exist. And that's what we see. And so, yeah, I considered myself an atheist for a long time, and I just finally realized that it doesn't matter so much whether the actual stories are true. You know, I find a way to kind of reconcile that. And I think Jordan Peterson actually had a good quote one time when someone asked him, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "Why is it any of your business if I believe in God?" But this is, for me, it's God and all that. It's bound up in the idea of civilization. I don't see there being one without the other. And so that's where I'm at in my religious ideation. And it's been pretty fulfilling. I mean, there is a lot of great things about Christianity where you become something greater than yourself. And so I would encourage, even if you're not a Christian or whatever, just find some spiritual path to go down that will bind you, that will tie you to other people. Because, you know, the thing that I have to come to terms with is that not everyone is like me. Not everyone is extremely motivated and interested in ideas, interested in abstraction especially, and so we kind of need to find something for these other people that will convince them of our ideas, that will give them a purpose. And for a lot of people, I've found that it's just not enough to have the truth on your side. Unfortunately, we are animals still, even though we may have become godly through our thinking. We're still animals. We're still flawed, and we're bound by emotions and we're moved by a lot more. You know, we have that reptilian brain beneath the prefrontal cortex, cerebellum or whatever. So yeah, it's, That's kind of why I've come to religion, is because it's more of a practical thing. I want to save my people and save truth. And so, but anyone who is interested in pushing back against globalism is an ally of mine, because I think that is the greatest purpose that we can be striving after at this point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to, again, put aside differences in terms of religion and favored economic systems and so forth, and focus on uniting around our common identity, but also uniting against the enemy. If you look at how the left operates, it's the most successful when it is able to unite against the right. And that's something that it does, you know, quite well. You have so many different factions on the left that disagree quite often. You know, you have anarchists, liberals, communists, Stalinists, Trotskyists, even within the communist, or rather under the communist banner. But they are able to just really focus on sticking, you know, they're united against the right at the end of the day. And they do have their issues. But the fact that they're able to stay focused on a common enemy really helps them. And that's something the right could learn from quite a bit as well. So you mentioned religion. Which denomination of Christian are you?
So I am a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or AKA Mormon.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to become a Mormon? I'm guessing that's something that happened fairly recently.
Yeah, it is. About last fall is when I converted, and I had visited the big temple out there in Salt Lake City, which is kind of the Mormon headquarters, of course, and was really struck by their appreciation for beauty, right? They have this great big temple that lots of people just volunteered their time to help build this thing, to carve all of the ornate decoration around it. And of course, there's the statue of Moroni, the golden bugle at the top of it. Mm-hmm. So beauty is something that I really appreciate as an artist. And I think that that is one of those things, as well as emotion, which moves people to action. And so I'm really kind of on a quest to reclaim beauty through my art. And yeah, Mormonism, it gets kind of a bad name, but and there are problems. I will admit that they've, you know, come out against racism, but at this point it's hard to expect too much from any church, any large organization, really.
Right.
And so right. Yeah, there's a lot of things that attracted me to it, and just kind of the fact that it's more America-centric rather than the other religions, which are centered around usually the Middle East, that area, Israel, Jerusalem. And so this is, I can still have Christianity, but it's an updated version. And, you know, to people who say, well, there's too much kind of Judaic influence on Christianity, I think that I would just come back and say that there are things we can learn from the Jews. There are there's a lot of pride that takes place, ethnocentrism. So I would say we shouldn't just abandon something because it was quote invented. And of course Jesus was rebelling against Jews too, so right. it's much more nuanced and complicated. And I would say that religion can evolve over time, and not in the progressive way, but in the kind of it can follow and it can match or keep pace with the evolution of ourselves, our tribes, and our biology. And so that is what I see. That's what I like about Mormonism anyway. And they have like a proclamation on the family. So they're super great on traditional values. But yeah, that's enough shilling for the church, I guess.
I do find it interesting because Mormonism isn't, you know, it isn't terribly common within nationalist circles, but at the same time, there are Mormons here and there. So I'm always interested to hear how they, you know, how they came to find the Mormon church and so forth. But why don't we switch gears a bit and talk about Trump? I want to hear your thoughts on the Trump presidency thus far.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So I've never been off the Trump train. I was an ardent supporter from the beginning, and he won me over not just in terms of what he was saying. A lot of people only look at what he's saying, and they don't really look at the man. And I think maybe this is because some people are uncomfortable with judging people. They're not great judges of character. But I saw Trump, and I saw that he is this guy who he's got very respectable children, right? And he also has dealt with a lot of people who are hostile to him throughout his career in his real estate career. And that is something that I think is valuable to us, because if you look at Saul Alinsky, right, it's you use the enemy's principles against them. And so I think that he is not one of these Republicans who they're just the principles are bust, right? And he's not a Neil Gorsuch who's going to betray their base. Well, some people would say he's betrayed the base in his presidency so far. And there's certainly been a lot of things that I've been upset with, Syria and not getting enough done on the border wall. But, you know, I see these things as part of his strategy. And yes, people will roll their eyes and say, oh, 4D chess Trump.
Right.
But hey, how do you think he won the election without a little bit of 4D chess? And so I think that he's viewing things in the long term, and it's okay to push back on him. But I think that when you look at his track record, I'm okay putting a little bit of faith, a little bit of trust in this man, that he won't completely betray us. Of course, you know, he's still a boomer. He's still susceptible to certain things, and that's why we definitely need to push back. But I think that a lot of his failings have actually been intentional. And I think that's what a lot of people don't get, is that he might be slipping up. Because you remember in the election, he had some slip-up moments where he would, I mean, there was the Pussygate thing, grabbing by the pussy. There was some other moments where, like the abortion debate, and he was able to recover from those, whether you think they were intentional or not, he was able to recover from them and use them to his advantage. And that is something he's very proficient at. He's very good, and he's very competent. He can get things done. And I think that if you had somebody in there who was one of us, even, or principled, I'm not entirely sure they would be getting stuff done. Or even if they were, it would be leading us down a path towards civil war, perhaps. Trump definitely wants to keep the country together, and you can say that's a bad thing because we are such a multicultural, diverse country. But you know, I'm interested in having kids, and I'm interested in seeing them safe, right? I'm not an accelerationist, someone who just wants to bring the end and cling on to the chain link fence.
Right. Well, on the subject of Trump and whether or not he is going to betray us or he's going to stay true to the Make America Great Again agenda, I do think that he's trying to some extent. However, my concern is that the issue with Congress isn't going to go away. It's not going to go away after midterms, and it might not go away, if he gets reelected. So he needs to start doing more without Congress. And sending troops to the border was a good first step. But we need to see more of that. I believe it was his first term, George W. Bush sent some 6,000 troops to the border. Now Trump is talking about sending 2,000 to 4,000 troops to the border. And that's again, a good start. But if Congress is not going to play ball, he needs to do literally everything in his power to secure the borders, to, again, do what he can to fix our immigration problem. And I haven't seen that at this point. I haven't seen him do everything that he can. And that seems to be the consensus among, most people who are supporters of him, but still critical. Ann Coulter, Jazz Hands McFeels, and others. But it is early. It is still fairly early into his first term. I think the chance of him getting reelected is definitely possible. We had Ryan Dawson on in the last show, and he talked about how he thinks Trump is going to build the wall in his third year, so we can have that as something that it's still fresh in people's minds for re-election. And I think that would be very smart. So I guess my position on this is I honestly expected more by now from Trump, from his presidency. However, at the same time, there's still time left. It's not like the situation's hopeless. And I do have faith that he's going to be able to accomplish more. The question is, how much will he be able to accomplish with an uncooperative Congress?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you mentioned the sending troops to the border, and I think they're not actually even detaining people, from what I understand. Is that right? It's just sort of a morale boost that they're going down there for.
Yeah, they can't do law enforcement activities, but what they can do is they can do things like, I'm pretty sure they can build fencing, they can build walls, they can help with surveillance, right? They could be on a base and helping to surveil the surrounding areas. But yeah, the National Guard can't go out there and actually, just start rounding up illegals and invaders as much as we might like the idea of that. But there are things that they can do.
Right, right. And I was just reading an article from Jazz Hands who was talking about how the media blew up something that Trump said about closing the borders, and he didn't actually even mean close the borders. He was probably just talking about closing down the government. So it's kind of funny how the media portrays him to be this person that we really want him to be, where he's actually against all legal and illegal immigration. I don't know, hey, maybe the media can meme that into existence. That would be nice, but
yeah, it's called the Posse Comitatus Act, which is a federal statute prohibiting the use of the military and civilian law enforcement. So that's what prohibits the National Guard from going out and rounding up illegals and deporting people and so forth. But again, there's something that they could do. And also there's something to be said for the fact that you need to keep the Trump base energized going into midterms and essentially, and particularly going into the 2020 election. Even if some of these things are symbolic, like sending troops to the border, although that isn't totally symbolic, but you do need to keep the base satisfied and energized. If they feel like nothing's happening, even if they are good reasons for things not happening, and even if things are happening but not at the pace that they might like, then the damage might be the same. People might just stay home on the voting day. So I think that Trump needs to continue. There's more that he can do, and I think that he needs to start doing it. And I do think that there's a good chance that he will. I've never been one of these people that thinks that, because we don't have the wall now, we're never going to get it, and the situation's totally hopeless. But, I agree with Ann Coulter, and I agree with Jazz Hands that there is more that Trump can be doing, and I look forward to seeing him do that.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Congress a while back, and it's not just Congress, right? We should remember it's also the media that is in the hands of the left. And so that's a big thing too. That's why he can't go out there really. I'm pretty sure Obama violated posse comitatus at some point. So that's why we're not allowed to, that's why the Republicans have to hold to their principles, and the left can get away with basically murder. And
yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind that the judiciary as well is against Trump. So he is facing the combined wrath of the, you know, the establishment, which transcends just the government. It is the media, it is the academic system, it is the judiciary, Congress, I'm sure many other, you know, NGOs, right? This, you know, Soros funded NGOs and so forth. They're all aligned against Trump. And I really like the neo-reactionary term, the cathedral, because I feel like that really gets at the power structure that that has really aligned against Donald Trump and against nationalists and right-wing dissidents overall. And obviously that would include the deep state as well, because he is, you know, doing battle with these intelligence agencies too. So he is up against quite a bit. And I think that the people who are overly critical of Trump and the people that veer into black pill territory should do well to keep that in mind. There's still plenty of time in his first term for things to change for the better. So to say that Trump he's sold out and he, you know, there's no hope left, I think that's taking it a bit far.
Yeah. One thing the left is, this is not a new talking point, but one thing the left is very good at is, of course, organization and activism. And they know how to get their people organized. They know how to rally people up, get them in the street, get them chanting something. And so there's people from the top, and they're just kind of feeding these down to the foot soldiers down below. And I wish we had more of that structure on the right, because we do have a lot of people who are frustrated and they want to do something, but right, they're just not sure what they can do and also what they can get away with doing. And so I would say that's why I really, you know, appreciate, I know you're now heading Identity Europa, but organizations like that are getting out there and they actually have a hierarchy where there is this uniformity of assault. And it is more like a military operation, although of course we're not using violence, right? But right. It's just yeah, it's just a way to accomplish our goals that's more effective. There is a place for kind of the creative anarchy, if you will, of ideas, and a lot can accomplish. We see that on YouTube and so on. But now that kind of our guy is in power, if you will, although not quite our guy, but close enough, Trump is in power, and we've got someone at the head at least, then I think we can start to rely more on organizations to accomplish things, because the left will always attack people first. That's one of Alinsky's tactics, and organizations can protect the people, and they can get the messages out, you know, banner drops, and if not necessarily marching on the street, you know, Charlottesville was a kind of, it didn't go as planned, but if we can be smarter about that in the future, then we can hopefully have a positive impact on people, and we can also beat the media to the stories. We can record everything and then immediately publish it to even before they publish it, and beat them to the chase. So all of these things, I think, are some of the practical aspects, which I'm not an expert on that. You know, people like, you know, yourself or Eli Mosley or others, like these people are better at the kind of organization of people. But I think that's really important. And I think that the ideas people need to kind of support and work with the more on the ground troops.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a place for people who are intellectuals and more philosophical to, you know, theorize and throw out ideas. But at the same time, there do need to be people who are out there putting them into practice. And I think that there are a number of people who are somewhat in between the two. I would consider myself as such. But yeah, we, as nationalists, as identitarians, we claim that we have a good model for society. We claim that society as it stands is plagued by a number of problems and we have the solutions to them. Just saying we have the answers to these problems isn't enough. We have to put them into practice. And we have to show people not only that we have a good model for society, but that we're capable of instituting it. And that's why I think that having organizations like Identity Europa and, you know, others as well, is a good thing, because it shows that, well, hopefully, if you're doing things right, it shows that you're capable of, you know, administrating effectively, that you're capable of affecting change, you know, to make society better, because that's, again, what we're trying to do at the end of the day. And I think the alt-right got a bit carried away with what could be termed folk activism. That's a term that Moldbug used a fair amount to describe basically what folk activism is. The name relates to the fact that we evolved in these tribal societies, you know, fairly smaller societies in the case of, you know, Western Europeans in particular. And so in our evolutionary history, we were used to going out. If there was a problem in society, we would go out and we would talk in the public square or amongst our fellow villagers and, you know, hash it out, and something would generally change for the better, right? But the way that power works these days in a modern industrialized society is far different than how power, you know, the power structure of a village with like 30 people in it. So if you're just going out into society and saying, you know, this is, the media is anti-white and, you know, the Democrats hate white people and there's a war on whites, right? It's not really accomplishing much. You're raising consciousness. You're raising ideas about what's going on, right? But that isn't enough. When you don't have sympathetic elites and you don't have a sympathetic power structure, it's just folk activism. You're going out and you're going through the motions and you're hoping that something's going to change just by you going through the motions. But it takes a lot more than that. We need to be building social capital. We need to have a movement with networks, infrastructure, funding, so that it can be a force in society, that it, again, not only has a vision for a better world, but actually has the people and the organizations and the funding that makes it seem capable of actually carrying that out, right? Because if you just say, oh, well, the world would be better if we need this and we need that and we need to institute these policies, but you don't have a track record of being able to complete projects and to turn things in on time and to run things well, then, you know, you're not going to be able to win over the kind of people that you need. I think that if we win over the common folk, that's great. But what we need more than anything else is we need to convince elites to defect. We need to convince elites who have a disproportionate amount of power, influence, and money that our model of society is better. And if we're not doing that, and if we have a movement where, you know, that only caters to people who have nothing to lose, then I don't think we're going to be successful. But it seems like the alt-right has learned quite a bit from 2017, with some exceptions. So I do think that the future of nationalism and identitarianism in America is brighter now than it has ever been, despite the setbacks that we faced in 2017.
Sure, yeah. I think that one way to summarize what you said would be to say that we need to make it profitable to become, to hold our ideas.
Right.
And not just monetarily, but also social status and so on, because people really do respond to incentives. And this is why Antifa groups and so on, they want to dox alt-right folks and put pressure on their employers. They want to make it so that It's not, not only does it not pay, but it costs you to hold these ideas. And so we want to, of course, do the opposite. We want to make it so that politicians understand. You know, I think it would just be the best thing if Paul Nealon could get elected, just because it would show that it is possible. And if he won, it would be because of the things that he said, not in spite of it.
Right. Well, I think that that ship has sailed, and it sailed quite a while ago. But yeah, I mean, I would like to see some politician running on a bit more radical platform than Donald Trump ran on find success. And I think that there's definitely the possibility for that happening. I don't think at this point that if someone was an open identitarian or nationalist speaking very explicitly about race and other similar issues that candidate would win. However, I do think that there has been space opened up for someone who is Trumpian, who on the core issues just sounds like Donald Trump, but, you know, at times veers into more politically incorrect, into more radical waters, essentially. But you have to do that very carefully if you're trying to win, if you're going for the electoral route. If you're going to be an intellectual or start a nationalist organization, yeah, you can have a little more leeway with what you say. But obviously, when you're trying to succeed in electoral politics, you have to tone down the message quite a bit. So Paul Nealon at first had a lot of potential. He was very promising. Now, when he went on Fash the Nation the first time, I was wondering how much that would, you know, prove to be an issue later on down the road. And he ended up kind of going off the deep end. So there wasn't, so we never really found out whether or not going on Fash the Nation once or twice would prohibit someone from winning a position in Congress. It's clear that there are many things that you just can't do if you're trying to run as a more, you know, nationalistic Republican, right? There are certain issues that you can't touch on, like it or not. So people really have to decide whether or not they want to actually win or if they want to just run an educational campaign. And I think that, you know, if you're going to run an educational campaign, then yeah, say whatever you want and try, you know, shock people and try to get them thinking about things. I mean, to his credit, Paul Nealon did get people, I think there are probably thousands, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who now know what the culture of critique is, people who did not know about that before Paul Nealon. But yeah, other than that, I mean, he just veered into very extreme territory in terms of what he was saying. And it just got to the point where there is no chance of him winning at this point. But
yeah, you do kind of have to master the dog whistle if you're going right to go down that route. And if I may, I'm working on a project where I'm collecting, I'm just keeping a tab in my notebook about every time I hear dog whistles online or in podcasts. And so I'm gonna do a little segment called Goy Whistles. So if anyone has any, they can, you know, DM me, send them my way.
Nice. So the idea for that would be to collect dog whistles from current politicians, potential politicians who are, so that you can.
Well, it could be politicians at, you know, Trump and other people. It could be just conservatives, more of the kind of Pat Buchanan is a classic one. And
sure.
So just to collect them all together. And I think it would be kind of an amusing bit.
Yeah, I think that would make for a good video, definitely. Well, Matthew, we should start wrapping up here. Before we do, what do you think the future holds for the dissident right or for nationalists or identitarians in America?
You know, I wish I had a crystal ball, but
right.
I would say I am hopeful because I see in our ranks a lot of courage. And especially now you see a lot more people, you know, I've always used my real name, but a lot of people coming out and just using their real name, whether it's because they've already been doxxed, or they just they feel that it's they're comfortable enough to put their name out there, and it's a huge risk. But that is one thing we have on our side is courage, and I think we also have the truth. And so those things, I don't know if it's enough to win on only those things. I think that I have to kind of hope that we're going to have a few other ingredients. We do have the talent right now. We have humor going for us. Of course, we're still lacking a bit in the funds. We're a young movement and so on. And a lot of us are younger working class folks. And so, yeah, I think that one thing, I think that will improve, that aspect of things will improve over time, because people will, these young guys will get jobs and hopefully become subscribers to Red Ice and also to donate to my channel and so on. But I think that we want to, you know, Chris Cantwell has said this a lot, is that the system we have right now is kind of a donation pinwheel, if you will, the hamster wheel. And so it'd be nice to get something else going where we can actually hire our own and support our own by giving them jobs, etc. So I would like to see something like that happen. And there is some degree of worry around social media, because more and more of these tech giants are clamping down, and that is reason for concern, because of course it's a catch-22. You don't know how to reach the masses if you're banned from using the platform that the masses are on. And that is something we're going to have to figure out. It might mean building our own platforms. People have said that for a while, but that of course is a long slog. Mm-hmm. And I wish there was a way we could just take them over, but that's I don't think we're as good at that as maybe our enemies are. But
not yet, at least.
Not yet. Yeah. So I'm generally hopeful, but I don't want to have too much optimism, because that then people lose the fire under them. So I would say that what we have now, it's a very good position to be in, but it's not nearly enough. And I just want to encourage everyone out there to be better and to figure out and be smarter too, be more efficient. Because we're lean, we have to be agile, and we have to move and learn from our mistakes. And I think people are starting to do that.
Absolutely. Well, before we sign off here, Matthew, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you on the internet?
Okay, thank you. I'm over on YouTube still. I actually was banned from streaming my most popular video. They've given me strikes twice on this video, and so I was banned from
streaming. What was the video?
Oh, it was Are Africans a Different Subspecies? So, you know, maybe a little bit controversial to some. But anyway, the channel is Matthew Drake. It's youtube.com/c/MatthewDrake1. And my work is called Illustrated Philosophy. They can go over to illustratedphilosophy.com. I'm also on Twitter at Philosophic Art.
Awesome. And you have a Patreon too, correct?
Yeah, I do. People can help support what I'm doing. You know, there are unfortunately very few artists on the right. I know of a couple other animators and some people are doing great music work out there, great parodies. But I am of the view that we can't have too much of that kind of creative content out there, because that is the type of stuff that will just, it will get people who aren't interested in ideas at all, because they're just drawn towards something. It just speaks to them aesthetically. So if you're an artist out there and you have some spare time, just start doing stuff. And if you want to collaborate, I'm always happy to collaborate with people.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for coming on, Matthew. We'll have to have you on again sometime in the near future.
That would be excellent. Thank you, guys.